Good morning. Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. I'm Chris Jimerson. I'm your lay leader today. We are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. We especially want to welcome those of you who are guests with us today. If you want to find out more about our church, please visit the welcome table in the foyer. Please join me in reading our mission statement together, printed in your order of service and on the wall. We gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice. Our reading this morning is from A Walk by Rainer Maria Rilke. My eyes already touch the sunny hill, going far ahead of the road I have begun. So we are grasped by what we cannot grasp. It has its inner light, even from a distance, and changes us, even if we do not reach it into something else, which hardly sensing it, we already are. A gesture waves us on, answering our own wave, but what we feel is the wind in our faces.
Well, it seems that Seattle has come to Austin in the form of Reverend Lena Breen and in the form of Reverend Ed Brock and now in the form of an entire weather system that has beset you. If you ever find yourself being curious about visiting Seattle, you don't need to anymore. You've had Seattle weather for the last 4 days or so. I don't know whether to love it or hate it, so I will just let go of my expectations and enjoy it. This Sunday, I am preaching the second in a series about change, adaption, and renewal. The first was entitled Letting Go. The second is The Art of Renewal, and I will preach a third sermon on this subject entitled The Art of Discernment, the last Sunday of this month. Renewal for me is always a movement of the individual, of the group, toward ever greater levels of wholeness, peace, and well-being. I believe there is something in us that naturally gravitates towards greater levels of wholeness, deeper levels of peace, higher levels of well-being, but that we must be in alignment with that natural movement of life. And one of the ways in which we thwart that process is by our clinging, our holding on, our attachment to that which needs to be let go. And our hesitancy, our fear about embracing what in life can move us towards that greater wholeness. This is primarily a movement of the individual. Without inner change. Is that somebody calling me? Without this inner change, there cannot be outer change. I have seen it. I have witnessed it again and again. Families, couples, groups, congregations cannot move until individuals within the group move towards higher levels of wholeness and well-being and take a stand there. And even though people might want to nudge them away from that position, if they take a stand, they will move the whole group towards higher levels of integration. And that's what leadership really is, whether it's in a family or a group or a congregation, is taking a position of higher integration, of higher wholeness. And by one's relating to the group, helping the entire group move in that direction. Martin Luther King Jr. did that with a whole movement of people, saying, I will practice nonviolent love. I will practice nonviolent change. I will not give in to the biases and the prejudices of the time. But I will not give in to them, nor will I be baited into acting violently against them. I will take on a posture of nonviolent witness to what I know is just and right. And by that stand, he moved people through a change that many were loath to traverse. Inwardly, we don't want change. We want things to stay the way they are, the way in our minds they should be and ought to be for all eternity. We don't want to let go of things. We want to hold on to things. We want to ever more intensely grip things, hold them. It is life which forces us to entertain the possibility of change. And in and through the changes of life that are inevitable and cannot be resisted, opportunities for that interchange await us. We can see this on the level of the individual, in couples, in families, in institutions, in congregations, in any group. It is always the same process. Consider for a moment the experiences of this congregation. 3 years ago, this congregation went through some significant difficulties. As a consequence of these difficulties, the congregation began to change. Some leaders from within this organization took that stand of saying, let's evaluate what has happened. Let's move to higher ground. Let's not be drawn into acrimony, but let us see how the past can be a teacher for us to ever greater levels of wholeness and well-being as a congregation. Let's be better through this experience. That is a great achievement. That is a wonderful achievement that this congregation can be very, very proud of itself about. And some of those changes that ensued were a mission statement. That didn't exist 3 years ago. A sense of purpose and direction. A statement of values. Statement of ends. This is where we're going. This is what is important to us. A covenant of right relations. A statement that, you know, when we enter this space, we are entering a kind of sacred space, as it were, where we are trying to be with one another in a way that allows compassion, understanding, mutuality to flourish. Policy-based governance, a boring subject for many, an exciting subject for me, which gives you a way to move into the future creatively and frees up your energies. And last but not least, and actually there's many more things I could mention, but in my list, last but not least, is a national search for a new minister that has garnered 30 people who are interested in being your minister. 30 people. When the consequences of these changes begin to manifest themselves 10 years from now, this congregation will be in a different place, will be a different congregation than it is today. It's not a matter of better and worse or higher and lower, but it will be, I believe, at a place of greater well-being and wholeness and healthiness. Now, all these changes, think about it, all these changes happened, are happening, because of a traumatic set of changes that no one could have anticipated or predicted. And these changes, when they were occurring, were viewed almost universally as negative experiences. Why? Because we don't like change. We fight change. We resist change. Change makes us anxious. But paradoxically, it is the changes of life that give us the opportunity to redefine and reconstruct life on a higher level of integration and wholeness. Now, it is possible, however, to not go in that direction. After all that happened in this church 3 years ago, it was a possibility that the church could go just right ahead with life as before, not call in consultants, not have marvelous interim ministers like myself, not create a mission statement, not create a covenant of right relations, and not create policy governance. Say, well, what's wrong with just doing everything the way we've done before? It was just somebody else, somebody intruded something bad into our system, which was perfect as it was. So why change? But you didn't do that. Therein lies a great achievement. President Obama, this last week, addressing the nation, said, "Let us be worthy of the life of that young girl who was killed, who thought so highly of the prospect of participating in politics. Let us," he asked, "let us live our lives so that we honor what happened here." That's a possibility. But it's also a possibility that our nation's leaders fail to respond. That's always a possibility. On an individual level, on a congregational level, on any collective level, that's always a possibility. If we respond to the inevitable changes of life with fear and cling ever more tightly to what was and not be open to what might bring us to higher levels of integration and wholeness, life stagnates. If we regard the changes of life in this manner, our lives can be transformed. A death in the family, a child leaving home, a child getting older, the loss of work, the change of life, the birth of a child, retirement, the family moving someplace new, the birth of a new child into a family that already has children, any big change is an opportunity to rearrange our lives at a higher level of integration. Let me return for a moment to the institutional level. I believe the UU movement right now is facing a change in its social reality, in the social reality that surrounds it. And in this change, there is an opportunity to redefine and restructure our religious movement. Let me explain. I believe that the social context which gave rise to a certain kind of Unitarian Universalism occurred during the last five decades is undergoing a powerful, very big change. For decades, at least five decades, people have come out of conventional churches and congregations into Unitarian Universalist congregations because it was a refuge, an alternative, a place where freedom reigned, a place to hide from religious and political repression. But the demographics that underlie that dynamic are changing. And one indicator of this is that the greatest source of our membership for the last five decades, namely people fleeing conventional churches, has significantly changed. From 1958 to 2008, mainline church membership dropped by more than 25%. From 1998 to 2008, there was a 22% drop in the percentage of adults attending mainline congregations who had children under the age of 18 living in their home. Bear in mind that these changes occurred in a period in which, from 1958 to 2008, the population went from about 175 million to 300 million. That is, the population almost doubled. Our denomination stayed fairly flat in terms of membership. Think about that. The Unitarian Universalist Church was the recipient of the outflow of mainline churches, Jewish and Protestant congregations, and other religious communities, fleeing what was perceived as an atmosphere of distrust and discontent with religious authority. But people coming to UU congregations today come out of a different social reality. They are looking for meaning and purpose and fellowship and a safe place for their children to understand religion and spirituality. They want some guidance. They want some understanding of life from a spiritual perspective. They want these things rather than an unending critique of convention. They are past that. The social reality they come from is past that. The societal background they find themselves in is not the conventional and tradition-oriented societies of the 40s, 50s, and even 60s, but the chaotic, distrustful of authority and the atmosphere rife with economic challenge and insecurity situated in a culture of acrimonious radio and television personalities. A world where ridicule of authority is almost the new norm, and people like John Stewart are the modern day equivalent of Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite was the embodiment of the normative values of society, the centrist, the center of gravity. John Stewart is the captain and the king of critique, of making fun of the foibles of the political leaders of our time. We live in a world, the younger generation lives in a world where The Onion has more appeal than the New York Times. It is a different world. The church in that context is their primary place for finding meaningful community experiences and to have some kind of relationship with the sacred dimension of life, whatever that might be. The experience of having gone through a process of being alienated, being attached to, and then alienated from a conventional religious institution is not there. They are at a new and different stage where discontent with traditional forms is a given. So where we are right now is a situation where there needs to be much more energy placed on clearly defining what our congregations are, presenting a positive identity to the world, and saying, this is what we contribute to the world. What does the Unitarian Universalist Church say to a society where things occur like the tragedy that occurred in Arizona not long ago? What do we as a congregation say about the world, about ourselves, about what is important so that we can be a genuine alternative reality to what is happening in this society? These demographic, social, and political changes are a wake-up call for our congregations. The question, who are Unitarian Universalists, was not a compelling issue for decades. When people were entering in a regular steady stream into our congregations from conventional churches, it wasn't a big deal to ask the question, who are we or what are we about? We were an alternative to what was out there. And so the issue of who are we, what are we about, what do we care about, what are our deepest core values, really wasn't a compelling matter. But what is often overlooked is the way this ambiguity about identity, caused by indifference to trying to define what we were, seeped into the very operations and ways our congregation lived its daily life. In other words, ambiguity regarding the identity of our movement worked its way over a period of decades into the way our congregations function. The ambiguity about Unitarian Universalist identity has translated over time into an ambiguity about issues such as who owns our congregation? Who is the authority in our congregation? What values will dominate the operation of our congregation? What will the goals of our congregations be? Take, for example, the question, who owns the Unitarian Universalist congregation? During the period I am describing over the last 50 years, the answer to this question was that who owns the church is the values and concerns of the people who have escaped here and found here a refuge from the conventional religious institutions around us. And the question of whether or not that addressed our core values was not brought up. This can be a good thing, but it can also be very problematic. For example, throughout the United States and Canada, there are many, very many congregations that have been stuck in the same place, the same size, the same situation for decades, and have no plans and no intentions to change in any way that will move beyond that. They are, in reality, from a certain perspective, a private club, which is being called a UU church. No one dares say that. However, there are no credible reasons for any other conclusion. And what happens in these situations again and again is that a congregation gets controlled by the values of a small group who represents the values of the refuge group, the group that sought refuge in our congregation decades ago, all for good reasons. But consider this for a moment. If our religious movement and the congregations in it have as one of their principles the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. What a grand principle that one is. But if indeed that was the principle of our religious movement as it is, would it not be the case that our congregations would be profoundly concerned about growth, profoundly concerned about being a prophetic voice for justice in our society? Would it not be profoundly interested in reaching out into their communities and letting their values be known proudly? And yet, as a religious movement, we have not grown. Even as the larger community from 1955 to the present has doubled in size. In closing, on an individual or collective level, we are caught in our clinging, our attachments, our refusal to see things as they are, our refusal to let go of what stifles us, and to join the flow of the river of life which moves us always towards higher levels of wholeness and integration. We are trapped in believing that the answer to our discomfort with change is to try harder to cling more tenaciously to more things, and to never let go. We Unitarian Universalists are geniuses at noticing how the fundamentalists cling to the past in their refusal to acknowledge the reality of evolution and in their biblical literacy and on and on. We are indeed geniuses at those perceptions.
We even, in our moments of weakness, might feel superior to fundamentalists for that clinging which we so intelligently see. But my friends, I think sometimes we outdo the fundamentalists, because at least you can say the fundamentalists are open enough to novelty that they've found ways for their churches to grow in creative ways. Have they not? What do the numbers say about the degree of our clinging? And how wise are we if we can see so brilliantly the failures of the fundamentalists and not see our own forms of attachment? It's only self-knowledge that matters in the end, not how brilliantly we see the faults and weaknesses of others. Our liberation lies in letting things be what they are, in being open to the reality of what is happening around us with as much honesty and clarity as we can muster. So I ask you and I ask myself on this beginning of a new year, where are we letting fear force us to cling, to remain attached? What are we shutting out for what we see as the value of preserving? This is the time of year where we have a chance to reflect on the spiritual practice of letting go and opening up to the things that are emerging in our lives, which lead us toward the personal and collective fulfillment, completion, and wholeness that life yearns for. May we embrace the journey. So may it be. Amen. I share with you these words of benediction. May there be peace in our hearts and minds. May there be peace in our homes and schools. May there be peace in our congregations and all places of worship. May there be peace in the halls of lawmakers and leaders. May there be peace across the land and throughout our world. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.